Fat Segundo here, and I'm extremely disappointed at the interlopers who have taken over my slot. Bad enough that I am suffering from a vicious sunburn, or that I'm still recovering from a terrible case of dehydration. Apparently, and I learned this quite accidentally, I assure you, in the desert, one can't live on tequila alone. But now it seems like the producers of this podcast can't arrange their foolish schedules around me. They knew what they were getting into when I signed the contract, and they knew that I am a man with unusual interests. And they have the temerity to offer imposters? Well, while you shall not hear me sanction the evil ways of the Bolshevik lip blog co-op, one thing I can get behind is talking with a number of smart and sexy ladies. Our young roving correspondent met with several contributors to some book called The May Queen. And while it may be the month of May, I have no idea what this means. Does it mean that I am expected to bow and curtsy every time I buy a girl a drink? Is there some queen preparing to step in at Pennsylvania Avenue and take over that cowboy? I don't know. I don't think our young roving correspondent knew what he was doing either. But this time at least, I can approve of his taste in interview subjects.
Okay, so I'm here at the Hotel Rex Bar, and I'm here with an amazing number of fantastically beautiful and witty and sexy ladies here. All part of this lovely anthology called The May Queen. So maybe we can go around the table and introduce everyone. Starting from the left.
I'm Megan Down.
Okay.
Erin Ergenbright.
Michelle Richmond.
Heather Jurgensen.
Kim Askew.
Nikki Richardson.
Nikki Richardson. The editor, by the way, of this. Well, first of all, the biggest question here is, who is this woman right here?
That 16-year-old girl on the cover chosen.
I was wondering.
Yeah, we definitely had a lot of conversation about that. That was a publishing
choice. There's a wonderful photographer in San Francisco named Deborah McClinton, who I really wanted to do her cover art, but unfortunately Tartu didn't want to use her. They wanted to use their stock images. So I'm really happy with the cover. I think it turned out remarkably well.
Okay. We think it's very virgin suicide.
Oh, gotcha.
It is.
Yeah.
And she's clearly not in her 30s.
No.
Clearly not.
Okay. So everyone in this book was required to write an epigraph of some kind. And I was wondering if you can sort of describe this. How did the epigraph process sort of begin?
That was my idea. I'm a fan of poetry, and so I thought that it would be nice to add a little extra touch. So I let all of the contributors choose their epigraphs.
Okay.
If they couldn't come up with one, like Carla Kilstead's, I chose something that was, I thought, somewhat adaptable or somewhat appropriate, so yeah, if they didn't come up with one of them. But I think everyone here did come up with their own. Yeah.
Okay, well, who has to go first? I know that Megan, you have to go, and...
Oh, don't worry about it. We'll just meander through.
Okay. Well, anyway, Megan, you wrote of the incomparable joy I take in being able to leave town on a day's notice. Specifically, you had a sort of essay here that was a little bit different from some of the other motherly essays, and I was hoping we could sort of broker the talk because some of you here are mothers and some of you are not. So maybe we can sort of discuss this issue. And,
I think there are only two moms here, right?
Are we?
That's because it's 10 o'clock on a Monday night.
That's right. That's the whole point.
Right. Yeah. They all had to go home and proffer their breasts to their screaming infants.
Okay. Well, seriously, this sort of divide, you raise a very interesting point in this essay, and that is that there is some sort of stigma on a woman not wanting to have children.
Yeah, it was a subject that I had attempted to write about a number of times, and I had written about it and even had the subject assigned for a couple of different magazines, and at one point I had an essay that was slightly different, well, actually significantly different than this version, and I was trying to sell it to a bunch of different magazines, and I can't tell you how many editors from Vogue to Harper's Bazaar to Elle just sort of said to me, oh, we're not going to run this because you don't mean this and you'll change your mind. And, these were editors who had nannies at home and full-time staff sort of, taking care of everything that needed to be taken care of so that they could run a major magazine. And I found that I was never really taken seriously in terms of this position. So I was really happy when Nikki approached me about writing a piece, and I thought, well, maybe here's finally a venue for this subject matter. So it was fun to rejigger it for the book.
Did you have you since you wrote this essay discovered an organic way of meeting people, or
an organic way of meeting? What do you mean? You mean
it's in the book? It's in your essay, actually. At the end, you sort of think about like meeting people in a more organic sort of way.
I think what I talk about in the essay. I mean, I talk about a number of things, but one of them is that, you know, because I seem to have been born without a biological clock, that I'm very sort of privileged in that I don't have this pressure. When I, you know, look at romantic partners or what have you, I don't have this pressure to sort of assess them in terms of how they would be as a father or as a provider. So that's a double-edged sword, because, you know, in some ways it's liberating, and then in other ways, you know, you can end up with a bunch of like derelicts who live under a bridge. And, oh, this seems like a fun guy, but you know, I think that it's very much a personal experience, and I'm not pretending to speak for everybody, but I do think that, you know, it's a complicated issue, and that the notion of you know, selfishness, really for me the crux of the essay is this notion of selfishness. I mean, you know, some people say it's selfish to have children, some people say it's selfish not to have children, and I think that's just sort of another way of kind of, you know, making women feel inadequate, and it's manipulative.
Them judge each other.
Let's go ahead and get the other people involved. Yeah. You think, what is with this sort of need, that it's selfish not to have children or to have children? I mean, maybe you can all sort of weigh in on this particular point. Do you have any thoughts on what Megan has just said? Or?
I actually, on another point of what she just brought up, this is Heather Jorgensen speaking, I think the biological clock is kind of the heart of the matter, because I'm in my mid-30s. I'm thinking about having kids now. I've definitely been putting it off. You know, I'm an actress. I'm in Hollywood. I'm in an ageist environment. I'm in a competitive business. I feel like I've always wanted kids, but I've also sort of wanted them at some point in the future. I've wanted, like, imaginary kids, or I've wanted kids that don't really impact my life or something. And I think that maybe speaks to the selfish aspect. I have felt selfish in that respect. But not, like, I don't think there's a pejorative there. It just means I've been focusing on myself as opposed to wanting to focus on a little baby, you know, needing to, like, suckle at my breast. But this shift I've been going through recently about sort of thinking I'm ready, I don't quite know how to explain it, except the reality of the clock really went off for me, or the reality that that's not changing. Like, there's an expiration tag on the uterus, and that's just how it is. So I was joking before, we just came from this reading that we did, and I was joking to one of the other writers that I think I'd really like to have a baby at 60. I really think that's when I'm going to feel ready. You know?
In the future, this will be possible. You know, not in our future.
I had a baby last year. I was 34 years old, and I can say, as a mother, I adore my child, but my husband and I very frequently have the conversation that we were not ready yet. But I think if I waited until 45, I still might not have been ready yet. And that's, I can completely see Megan's point of view, because I don't think that everyone who has children has children because there's an imperative to have children. I think for some of us, well, for me, I felt as though there were all these things in my life I had experienced. I hadn't experienced that, so I wanted to do it. And then I just sort of felt the clock ticking, but it wasn't my personal clock. It was the doctor saying, if you want to do it, you have to do it now.
Yeah.
You know, and
but who else can you trust, right, except the scientific establishment? I mean, left to my own devices, like
who
I said.
Who can you trust other than your HMO, really?
but this is actually a very valid thing. If men can have Viagra, why can't women have babies at 60?
Well, you know? I'm not sure that's analogous. Exactly.
I don't know.
I just was very impressed. There were a few years ago, a group of OBGYNs, I don't remember the name of this group, it was like a trade group of doctors, took out billboards all across, I mean, I saw them in LA, but I think it was a nationwide campaign, literally saying, ladies, this whole thing of having babies in your 40s, it's a myth. It doesn't work. We've tried. It's like Madonna did it, but don't think you're just going to do it just because a couple of famous ladies have done this. And I remember being very, very, I was like struck by this, because these are doctors who should be making their living off 40-ish women. And they were really kind of saying, don't starting at 35. It was really a strange campaign, I thought. And it, I guess it did make an impression on me, because I think we're so used to science solving whatever we want it to solve, that I think we're just now saying, yeah, you can have a baby at 45 if you want, that's fine. Well, it seems like you can't. Like, you know, it's not like science is moving in that direction exactly.
It's but it's not just science, it's also women's issues. Like in your essay, you point out Diane Peepee as this person who is aging naturally. And I also will confess that I have had a crush on Diane Keaton since I saw Annie Hall as a teenager.
Right.
But that's beside the point. The point is
we've
that
all had a crush on
yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
And girls and boys alike.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, what makes her different? I mean, how do we go ahead and actually make older women sexy? And this might actually bring in another question. What do you all think of Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct 2? She's like 50, and she's going ahead and doing...
She's 48. She's 48. She's not
yeah.
50.
Okay, well...
Well, that just brings up the whole subject of plastic surgery, which yeah. I get into my essay a little, and it's I find it very depressing, but it's part becoming more and more part of the world, and what I say in my essay is I really just want to see women's faces aging naturally because I want to see what they look like.
Yeah.
I mean, did anyone watch Dolly Parton at this year's Oscars?
Oh, yeah.
It was shocking.
Yeah.
I mean,
her
it was,
waist was like 20 inches,
I don't,
maybe.
But like
go
the
to Fred
face,
Siegel any day.
I mean, I just saw because they're releasing the DVD of 9 to 5 right now.
Yeah.
So there's been some press about it, and that was, I think that was released in 1981. And there's a photo of her like in a magazine that's out right now, and I saw it, and Dolly Parton is, you know, cherubic, and her face is, like, fat and plump and adorable and womanly. And at the Oscars, I mean, it was a death skull. It was a death skull.
Yeah.
And it's not natural, and it drives me crazy, but so many women do it that there's this strange, we don't know what a woman looks like anymore.
Frances McDormand has said that she's not going to go under the knife because she wants to have the parts that the women that have had plastic surgery are not going to get in 10 years.
Uh-huh.
If you've seen the documentary Searching for Deborah Winger, I think it came out 2 years
yeah,
ago,
yeah.
It kind of addresses some of the same issues that Heather addresses in her essay.
Okay.
Where in every scene, Rosanna Arquette, you know, enters every scene saying, "You look fabulous," every woman.
Right.
I mean, it's a great documentary, but I just thought it's ironic. It's right. Like, you know, she has to comment on it. It's
on their appearance.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's really strange that as the, like, I just turned 34, and all the women I'm seeing in Hollywood who are 40 and 50 and 60, they look way younger than I do. I mean, so it's a weird place to be. I'm not completely sure how I feel about plastic surgery. I know I wouldn't do it until much later if I did, but it's so odd to be in that place where, I mean, Cher looks like she's 20 years younger than I am.
But
and
yeah.
It's really confusing, you know?
But in your essay also, you point out that it's, you know, your own sort of self-worth is very much tied into a woman's image.
Sure.
And maybe you can talk about how you sort of went about that in your essay, and maybe we can kind of get into a roundtable about this.
But I don't know that that was as... Well, I guess it is tied to appearance.
I mean,
but
it was tied to appearance and being gentle and good to oneself. It seems to me that, like, sometimes when a woman goes under the knife, it's almost as if she doesn't feel that she can be good to herself as she exists, as she is, you know?
Right. Well, it's definitely... It's kind of a violation of your body to cut yourself up to please other people. But, I mean, there's so many violations of our bodies that we do for other people. But I mean, I think that even ties back into the judging whether you're having children or not having children or not being married when you're 34 and, you know, if people think there's something wrong with you. And the lines are getting blurred a little more now, and so people don't necessarily expect you to be married at 25, but those pressures are still there. And it's strange to feel like we've developed, our society's developed in so many ways, but then there's some really basic things, like you have to look good when you go out, you have to, you know, you have to be coupled. I was recently in a relationship and found that so many of my friends who are in relationships, they were so much more at ease. Suddenly, they were... I don't know if it's that they could invite me to things that only couples could go to, but I felt this collective sigh of relief, like, oh, she's with someone and he's so nice and it's great. And of course he wasn't just you know, nice. I mean, he was nice, but it wasn't as simple as I thought it was going to be necessarily. But I did feel like everyone knew what box to put me in. She's okay. She's
But don't
she's
you think part of that could have been girlfriends wanting you to be happy?
Yes. I absolutely.
Not that you can't be happy by yourself, but, you know.
No, it wasn't necessarily a bad thing, but I did feel... Yeah, I hope that's what it is. And I'm sure that they saw me through this ridiculous thing that I wrote about, and of course they would want me to be happy. But it just was a little strange because I was happy for that. You know, I don't necessarily need to be.
Maybe we could talk about this, the whole sort of like, if you are a single at one of these sort of parties and you're like the only unsingle person there, you know, you're the only like person who doesn't have a partner or kids. I mean, what I find in some of these things is that the kids sort of flock up to you. But at the same time, though, how do you think this is damaging towards sort of women's self-perception or women's issues that we're kind of talking about right here?
Do you mean the idea that you have to be with
The idea that you have to be with someone, you have to sort of couple. Megan's idea in the sort of like, you know, that you have to have children. What do we do to sort of break this stigma? What do we do to sort of like tell people, hey, it's okay for you to sort of like, you know, not go by this sort of like, you know, expected life choice, the marriage, the home, the career, etc.
You know? Well, you know, this is a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I do feel that we married people with children should just go out into the world. Like, I feel like I should take my boy out into the world, like, to Planned Parenthood meetings, and people will decide that they don't want children. My son is amazing. He's wonderful, but, you know, I think if people see what it's really like to have a child, they might, you know, decide, well, you know, I'm not really into that. But also, I think as a married person, I love my husband. I love being married to him. I can't imagine a more perfect husband. But does that mean that I don't think, oh my God, I'm missing out on the sex? Yeah, I mean, the sex with him is great, but yeah, I'm missing out on the sex with other people. You know, you enter into this marriage contract.
Really,
you're
this.
Not missing any of that. I can tell you there's no other
I'm not
sex.
Missing
no, there's no sex. Sex does not exist, really.
That's so true. I just feel that as a married person with children, I can play the devil's advocate in that I love what I have, but I also see what I'm missing, and I think most married people can also see that if they sort of think about it.
I think Heather Chaplin in her essay, she's not here tonight, but she does talk about that. She's been married since she was in her early 20s, and she wants to have sex with other men. She wants to live her life fully, and she feels somewhat like she married young, and she's missed out on opportunities, you know, and she's really conflicted in her essay, and also just writing it, like she was afraid of what her husband would say after having exposed this part of her secret feelings. So,
well, let's also talk. Kim, you've been relatively silent, and I'm not going to let anyone be. everyone has to answer anyway. But Kim, you write of sort of finding kind of ambiguous but sort of certain kind of comfort in San Francisco. You go through this period where you compare sort of like, you know, going to Los Angeles and sort of like having possibly kind of an affair but not sort of giving yourself completely to this.
Right.
But this was interesting to me because, first of all, you have very sort of certain kinds of things that you are discovering in this essay, and yet there's a lot of things that are uncertain. And maybe we can sort of talk about this. Maybe you could start in terms of like just letting yourself go and sort of accepting life and accepting finding your place. Which you do, I think, in this essay.
Right. I think it's something that we were talking about a little bit earlier after the reading. I kind of, in my early 30s, was like, what have I not done and why haven't I done it? And at this point, I'm 35 now. It's been 4 years since I did my first draft of the essay, 3 or 4 years. And now I'm kind of back where I want to be, and it's more about doing everything that I haven't done and not worrying what it was that I didn't do, but experiencing everything that I wanted to, mm-hmm. I guess.
Well, I mean, though, but at the same time, is there anything like the sort of like hearing the cable car ding and knowing that is sort of where you want to be? What has happened in the last 3 or 4 years since you wrote?
Oh, yeah. I mean, moving back and kind of being in a community with other people who are more like me, kind of the writing community that's here, I felt a lot more accepted here. And then also, to be honest, not to say anything against LA, but when I went out there, nobody...
Oh, say it.
Yes, say it. We are San Francisco United.
Okay, let me tell you. So when I lived in LA, I would go out and I felt invisible. And here, wherever I go, if I'm hanging out at a coffee shop having coffee, and it may be my own, what I'm putting out there, but I will make friends every day walking around. I see the flower seller on my street when I'm walking to work. The guy who runs the store a block from me, like that feeling of community and appreciative
camaraderie
is...
Yeah.
So
because people don't drive cars here, that's why.
Exactly. Well, that's part of it. But I don't feel invisible here. I mean, I feel a part of San Francisco.
Maybe we can.
That I didn't feel there.
Maybe we can open up this question to the group. The whole notion of like, so at what point have you all sort of like, you know, respectfully kind of just said, oh well, to hell with what I have to do, you know, at a certain age, or I mean, how much are you still guided by this sort of like age? Kind of like age-oriented goals, or I mean, maybe we could sort of.
Well, I remember the day that I decided that it didn't matter if my wedding appeared in the New York Times style section.
You thought it was going to?
My gosh! I mean, it's you know, it's called the women's sports pages and
what?
The women's sports pages.
Wow.
The New York Times.
Yeah.
Oh, no, the wedding section of the New York Times is. Is seminal. I mean, for
one
some,
of the other
for so many women.
She'll hate me for saying that, but she was her wedding announcement. Was
oh after. Well, I mean, absolutely. And I remember there was a time. It was probably when I was in my early 30s, and I had this Sunday morning where I was all of a sudden like, you know what? I don't care if my wedding is not in the New York Times. You know, I don't care if the person I marry didn't go to an Ivy League college or has parents who do something that would warrant, you know, a mention in the New York Times. And it was, like, radical.
It could have been much worse. It could have been one of those, like, modern love articles in the style section. So, you know.
Well, the modern love... Oh, well, no, those are the... No, as freelance writers, we need the modern love column. Let's not muddy the waters here. But
well,
no,
if you get married and divorced really young, like I did, then you don't have any need for that. you get over that really quick.
Well, they do have a thing in the New York Times where they check back on people who were in the vows column like 10 years ago.
I think the zero birthdays are really helpful for checking in with yourself. Like, they're just landmarks. They're like, okay, 10 years has passed. What have I done? I recently made a film with a woman. The director is 70. And she's making another movie right now. She's extremely, extremely talented and energetic. And it's like, I look at her and I'm thinking, she doesn't seem to be fazed by her age. She doesn't seem to be aware of her age. She's doing exactly what she wants to do, and I marvel at it because I do think I will be thrown when I turn 50, 60, 70. You know, the older, I think 30 and 40 have their challenges, but like as a woman, I think those are the ones that are really hard. And this particular woman seems totally oblivious. And I think that's all, I mean, speaking for myself, that I can hope for is that I continue to do what I want to do in this life and not be thrown by the new zero birthday that pops up at me.
You know, Ed, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I'm 35 now. 10 years ago when I was 25, I had all of these goals that I was nowhere close to meeting yet. Well, 10 years, a decade down the road at 35, sure, I haven't done every, you know, I haven't won the National Book Award, and I realize that I never will, but these other things have happened that when you're in your 30s, I think you can be far more comfortable with what you have done, obviously, I mean, just by the necessities of time, than you can when you're in your mid-20s, so... While you may not have gotten everything you wanted, you've gotten a great deal. So it begins to matter less what you haven't done because so many things have sort of come your way or you've been able to make things happen that, you know, when you were in your 20s, you weren't really nearly as close to having those things happen. So I think a lot of it is you're able to redefine what you... Heather earlier was talking about ambition and how ambition just sort of, there's this tension that ambition creates when you're in your 20s. When you're in your 30s, you have goals, you have desires, you have ambitions, but they don't define you in the same way because you have realized some of them. So it's easier.
You give yourself a break.
I feel like I need to add a postscript to the ambition thing. I was actually quoting Carla's essay, which is, she says she felt in her 30s ambition morphed into trust. And I think that is true, but I think it would be dishonest if we didn't point out, at least for myself, that morphing, there's a certain mourning involved. I mean, I remember I was driving to San Diego once to teach a seminar in indie filmmaking, and I really felt, I don't want to be teaching a seminar in filmmaking. I want to be making another movie. And it was painful for me, and I wept the entire drive to San Diego.
Yeah.
I mean, and it was excruciating in a way, and yet at the end of that trip, I felt more at peace. Like, it's okay, you know, sometimes you're going to be making movies, sometimes you're going to be teaching people how to make movies. But I know, want to be honest here, because I read all your essays, and they were very honest. It's fine to say ambition turns to trust, but I do think there's some growing pains in that period where you're grappling and struggling with that ambition turning into trust, and it's not always easy.
Well, at the same time, this begs another question. Why so much attention? Why does our society have so much attention on the 30s decade? It seems, particularly now, there was at the reading, Kevin posited the Grupps article, which is actually an interesting premise. It sort of exposes, it basically sort of like quibbles over the fact that people in their 30s and even their 40s are sort of living lifestyles that are, you know, in their 20s. Maybe we could sort of start to examine why society is so particularly judgmental towards the decade of the 30s.
Judgmental, though? I just think of it as such a powerful time.
Oh, because you're young and you have some spending power.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a marketer's dream. I mean, you're not over the hill aesthetically, but you have some sort of, you have capital, you know. You have
so to monetary clarify, and when cultural you say capital, judgmental, are you saying, just can you just refine what you mean by judgmental?
Well,
because I also don't
that
think...
society, well, you know, we've sort of offered numerous examples about how women are judged, just as 30-somethings are judged, like in this article about the Grupps, where these people are being judged because, oh, well, they still, you know, play in rock bands. Or
what
they still...
What does Grupps mean,
well,
anyway?
It's basically came from an old Star Trek episode, a short for grown-ups. This writer was hoping for sort of like a David Brooks Bobos kind of thing. So it Grupps. Didn't quite work.
So
Grupps.
Fell a little short.
Yeah, exactly. But he made, and it was several sort of sweeping generalizations in this article, but it did have a very valid point. I mean, I've seen a lot of people now in their 30s where they're almost indistinguishable from, like, say, someone who is in their early 20s in both what they wear, what they listen to, where they go to. And this kind of ties into all the essays that are in this particular book where, you know, a lot of what this is, it's not just about you perhaps judging yourself and kind of getting over that, getting to that point where ambition turns into trust, as you say, or as that other essay said, but also, you know, getting beyond sort of society's sort of judgment of particular sort of age groups about where they should be. And I'm rambling incessantly, but I'm hoping one of you can jump in.
I kind of wonder how much of it sometimes is an urban versus non-urban thing.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, if I were living in the town where I was born, perhaps I would, you know, have done everything a lot earlier. I would probably have several kids in school now, maybe one of them in high school. I would be living a different life than I am because I live in a city and I'm artistic and that sort of thing. I mean, I think that's a big difference. I think that there are plenty of people who are living life the way that it's supposed to be lived, quote unquote.
Sure.
I think Kim has a really good point. I grew up in Mobile, Alabama, which is a medium-sized southern town, and my friends there all have children who are, you know, and then, you know, anywhere from 8 years old to teenagers and graduating from high school. Whereas here, I'm 35 years old and I'm kind of an oddball that I have a kid already. It's like, what do you do? You know, why do you? But I do think that's a good point about the difference between age in urban and non-urban environments.
In fact, when you said it, it reminded me of this wonderful Saturday Night Live spoof commercial that they did recently for Mom Jeans.
Oh yeah, I totally saw that.
And you know, the SNL women are so great right now, like Maya Rudolph and
well, you know, yeah, what's the blonde?
At least, well, Tina Fey is a writer.
Well, anyway, the point is they're all wearing these jeans that come up to their boobs, basically.
Big, like the opposite of Desperate Housewives.
Here's my big fat ass in these big ugly jeans with big pockets, no styling, like just ugly. And they're like, now we're not, now that, you know, we don't have to be women, we're moms. That was like the tagline for mom jeans. And as you were speaking, I realized, I said, no woman I know in LA or New York where my mom friends are would ever wear a pair of mom jeans. Mm-hmm. That's more, I think, like suburbia or rural.
Right.
But they do exist. You know, you go to JCPenney and you pick up a slew of mom jeans because you're done. But I think in the urban environment, women are like, I'm just going to dress how I want to dress. And if I look like a 25-year-old, that's like... I too bad for you if you have a problem with that, I think is the idea.
When I was signing books, a woman came up to me and she said, you know, where are the contributors from? Are they all from cities? And I was like, yeah. I mean, I half-heartedly admitted it, but it's true. Like, I had a hard time finding women. I wanted it to be as inclusive as possible, but I had a really hard time finding women in middle America that could be in the book. I mean, I wanted to find women that could write, number one. But I hope that what's interesting is one of the women who wrote an article about me from Tennessee, which is where I'm from, she said she was a little intimidated by the contributors, but after having read the book, that it spoke to her and it still resonated with her. So that made me feel a little bit better.
I'm just glad I did not read this book before I contributed, because I would never have gone head to head with these ladies.
Why do you say that, Heather?
I'm just saying, I think it's the writing is beautiful, and I think I would have been too intimidated to send you an essay, so
that makes me feel good.
You know, on that point, though, of age and youthfulness and youth culture, I think I might come from a slightly different perspective because I teach college, and almost all of my students are graduate students, but even so, my graduate students are 22 years old. There's a fairly large divide between me and them. And I do notice a difference in my culture and their culture, but the wonderful thing about teaching is that I feel I can voice my my literary tastes upon them. But musically, I think I think that gap gets a lot smaller when you talk about music, you know, than in other issues regarding age, but.
Sure.
I mean, I think we read a lot of the same magazines when it comes to pop culture. I think we're all exposed to, you know, whether you're 22 or you're 32, you're getting exposed to the same pop culture, you're getting exposed to the same messages.
Well, it's also possible that, like, the generation below us here just really isn't producing anything provocative that will make us kind of sort of say to ourselves, I'll turn that damn music down, you know? I mean, I'm wondering... Or there's the other possibility that it could be some sort of like kind of almost a curious form of revolution, meaning that people are not necessarily willing to give up on their particular passions. Or there's some. I mean, it's sort of. I think the Grubbs article sort of says something about the way that people are kind of, you know, starting to kind of like not think within particular sort of like age brackets. That there is some sort of possible shift. Maybe it's
marketing.
It could be marketing. Well,
look at Johnny Cash appealing to, you know, that's somewhere where my students and I can converge.
Yeah.
And Johnny Cash that's also somewhere where my father and I, right, Republican,
my dad
from
as well,
Alabama,
yeah,
can
I've
converge.
Been listening to Johnny Cash since I was, you know, like a baby.
So, well,
but
can't
I think
get behind
that,
Johnny
that,
Cash,
that
yeah.
Yes, yeah. There is this sort of streamlining quality of marketing.
And
now,
I think that the marketing and advertising, they've been progressing, they're getting better at it. You know, it's something that wasn't there as much 100 years ago. And it's getting better and better, and we're all kind of going along with it. And I'm cool with that.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to also make sure I get everyone's direct questions to everyone. But Michelle, you mentioned also in your essay the notion of getting ready, how there's nothing in our sort of culture, or particularly the way you grew up specifically, in which you weren't sort of like, you know, allowed to sort of like, well, look, you're going to have to get ready for that sort of like, you know, wandering down life's path of deciding exactly what it is you want to actually do. And maybe you can maybe talk about that. Maybe all of you might be able to talk about this, how there is, you know, I mean, do you feel that there's an absence in terms of like your own personal kind of life quest to have kind of like wandered to the point where you're at right now, all respectively?
I'm sorry. There's an absence of like a wandering, a way of getting there by wandering?
Well, I'm sorry. So the path in life you find that you write about in your essay, how there is, your mother prepared you for almost everything in your life except for sort of going down that particular path. At least that's what the conclusion I drew from reading your essay. Maybe you can talk about this or elaborate on this.
Well, I got into my essay just by sort of this very physical and light idea of physically getting ready to go to church or to go out every morning, which was very much part of my upbringing in the South. But as I was writing about that, I realized that I had spent much of my life getting ready for a particular point in my life. You know, that this idea of getting ready had really extended throughout my entire life, and I had gotten ready for things. And finally, they happened to me in my 30s. But, I mean, they didn't all happen, but some of them did. But I do think that we miss a great deal when we're younger because, and you know, this starts at a very early age. It doesn't start when you're 20. It starts when you're 5.
Yeah.
Because when you're 5 years old and you see your older siblings knowing how to read books and, you want to emulate that. You want to be able to do that. And then when you're 20, you are spending your time preparing for this future life you imagine yourself having. And I think in Western cultures, we don't allow ourselves much time for just sort of this journey of wandering about and finding sort of where we're going to go. Although I think that perhaps this is different in my generation than it is. My sister is 28. She's done a lot of wandering. She's still doing it, but she has an idea. You know, she's a photographer, and that's what she wants to do with her life. But she has allowed herself a great deal more freedom. With me, when I was 21 years old, I thought, I have to know exactly what I'm going to do and where I'm going, and I'm going to hit these points.
My sister and I are exactly the same.
Yeah, and Kim and I have talked about this. I have arranged my life in that way. I'm going to hit these points. And that's sort of what I did. It was a very clear-cut path for me from probably the age of 15 on that I was going to hit this, this, and this and get there. That's what happened. And I wonder what would have happened if I had allowed myself a little bit more leisure in taking the path. And I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but was thought-provoking. It just sort of made me think about those things.
Well, it's also reminiscent of also like Aaron, and you kind of point out that really there is no sort of timetable for these sort of things. I mean, and yet society and magazines in particular insists upon ramrodding these kinds of timetables down women's sort of throats. So what do you do to consciously reject these? I mean, I think to some degree we're all sort of susceptible to this, you know.
Well, I would say I don't think it's just women. I think men certainly have a timetable too, and I think that's why men have midlife crises. That's why they invented the midlife crisis. And I just while you were speaking, I thought of, in high school in New York, I was taught by Frank McCourt, who went on to write Angela's Ashes and Win the Pulitzer and all this stuff. And he wrote that at 60. And we, his students, were so blown away by that. Because he was a great guy, but he was our English teacher. He was a New York City public school teacher, whatever. And then he's winning a Pulitzer. And he did it at 60. And, you know, it sounds corny, but it's like really anything is possible at any age. You just have to do it. And what he said was if he didn't write that book, he was going to go to his grave howling. And I feel like that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to not go to our graves howling, but not be so married to the timetable that we make ourselves crazy in the moment.
You know? Aaron, you had a thought, too.
That's what I was going to say. I think I was on the path so firmly that I still had all the stuff to figure out. So I went to college and I went to graduate school and published a book, and then I just completely fell off the path because I wasn't really ready to be on the path, and so I had to meet all these bad men and just follow through that muck. And it's like I'm getting on the path again, but I there was so much I needed to figure out. I wasn't ready to when I was younger. It was on a different timetable, and sometimes I'm trying now. I just turned 34, and even coming across the bridge from Berkeley today to go to this, I had this moment of, oh, you should have done this thing before now, and I kind of thought, you know what, screw it. So what? I didn't.
Yeah.
Or I didn't yet. But for some reason in the last year, or even the last couple of weeks, I've just had this different relationship with what I should have done and what I have done, because it doesn't really matter. I just feel less...
You should have done what before? What did you mean?
Well, just, I don't know, just those things. You know, my friends from Iowa have all published 4 books, and, you know, I'm not keeping up with them. And I just had stuff to do.
Who,
I had
who
stuff
cares about
I
that?
Had to... Well, it's easy to say that, but unless you actually feel that, unless you can say who cares about that and believe it, then it's not helpful. It's just
if
somebody.
If you're working as a barista at Starbucks, you want to publish. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
It's like you wake up in the morning and you've done something or you haven't done something. It is.
And there's always someone who's done it more or better.
It's the ache of wanting to express why you're on this planet. You know? I mean, it's hard.
It is. So I don't know. It's exciting to change your relationship with those milestones. And it doesn't mean that I won't do those things. And there were people that I knew at Iowa who were a lot older and who had taken a different path. And I guess I'd always thought I would be a writer. And then so to find yourself circumventing that and then coming back, it's just, I'm just so happy not to be 30 anymore. You know, I'm so thrilled.
Totally. You are a writer.
Gosh. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, going back to Nikki, because you've also been silent, I'm trying to include everyone. You wrote in your introduction that you were sort of stunned by how many women crave the opportunity to hash out their perspectives on aging. And it seems to me, I'm a little stunned at just the level of sort of, you know, variety of opinions on aging. Maybe we can sort of talk about this. Maybe you can start by...
Sure. I was interviewed by this San Francisco Chronicle this afternoon. Heidi Benson interviewed me, and she was doing an article on... women's anthologies, the prevalence of women's anthologies right now. And I was just saying that I felt like it's kind of a backlash to this chick lit phenomenon that I find completely demeaning and belittling. I don't know where I was going with that, but I was going to say, when I was talking to her...
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, who's writing the anthology?
Heidi Benson's doing an article for the Chronicle about women's anthologies, the prevalence of women's anthologies.
Oh, great.
But your question again was...
Well, the question was on specifically the perspective in aging. And how many women are sort of drawn to this, and the level of varying sort of opinions
the level
that we've
of
kind
variation
of. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How everyone has different sort of, you know, approaches to this aging, and there's some similarities and some differences.
Well, Nikki, what's your problem with the chiclet thing?
Well, yeah, what is your problem with the chiclet thing? I'm curious.
Well, I was watching the Daily Show the other day, and I love Jon Stewart. He's like my boyfriend, kind of. And he was interviewing Cameron Diaz for In Her Shoes, which just came out, and it's by Jennifer Weiner, one of the contributors. I just watched it on DVD, and it's really just a story about human stories. It's not
It's an excellent movie.
It's a good book, too.
A great director, Curtis Hanson, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just really pissed me off that he was, like, completely, you know, just, oh, chiclet. He wouldn't even let her speak.
So it's more people calling things chiclet, not the actual...
The labeling of chiclet.
Well,
you know, It's undermining women's experiences, that all the things that we have to accomplish in our 30s, whether it's creating a family, having a career, whatever it is, it's undermining that by labeling it in that way. So.
Well, what do the rest of the peanut gallery think about this chick lit phenomenon and chick flicks, and the fact that something has to be bad if it's chick or if it's
the
classic.
I think it comes back to the notion that we need to categorize things, because I remember when Melissa Banks came out with Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing.
Yeah.
I thought those were beautiful stories. I personally thought they were well-written, lovely. When Jhumpa Lahiri writes Interpreter of Maladies, you know, that's an Indian American's perspective.
Yeah.
When, if you read those stories side by side, they're often about the exact same things. They're about relationships, they're about marriage, about growing up, about divorce. And one is called chick lit, and one is not.
Is that
and
marketing, though?
I think it is marketing, you know.
Well, also there's the fact that, like, I can't read a Jennifer Weiner book without having the pink cover, so I get weird glances from people on the bus.
Our spine is hot.
Yeah, and we've got pink
idea
here, too. Yeah.
Who the market is.
But
no,
they wouldn't exactly pander right without women spending money on chick lit.
Yeah,
so,
right,
again, it comes back to the consumer, which are, in this case, women, I suppose.
But I'm a man who reads Jennifer Weiner here. I'm a man who has read Bridget Jones' Diary,
right,
believe it or not.
Well, God,
you know,
Bridget
I
Jones'
like...
Diary is a brilliant, subtle, subversive novel. And unfortunately, it just spawned this, you know, sort of diluted version of the same thing that then took on all the connotations of the genre.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pity that chick lit is now this garbage category that means everything, when in fact... you know, at its best, it could mean this thing, and at its worst, it means something that's worth.
But somebody named it that, and they took it and made it something else.
What's even worse, though, is that when you have Curtis Sittenfeld, a prominent woman's author, actually attacking certain authors as chicklet.
Right.
So what you have here is a situation where, you know, women are sort of attacking their own kind. What do you feel about
Do you think that she's attacking their own kind?
I
think Curtis Sittenfeld very much attacked her own kind, because I thoroughly enjoyed the book Prep, but Curtis Sittenfeld's original New York Times article attacking chicklet attacked it on the basis of it's an entertaining thing that you don't really think much about later, which was the very definition of the book Prep. And so I think that, and here I am attacking her, but I feel that I have a reason to do this, because I think that I enjoyed Prep. I think it was a great book, but to hold herself as intellectually higher to the books that she was attacking was really inappropriate, given the book that she had written herself.
Yeah. But also because Jennifer Weiner's books in particular are very, very, some of the most astutely observed sort of women's behavior in fiction, I think.
And in 100 Ways of Looking at the Novel, Jane Smiley chooses a Jennifer Weiner book as one of her books to examine as a book for writers to look at, is how to write a novel.
Well, with such a stigma on both films and literature then, what do we do to sort of take this label back and just make a book that happens to deal with, like, you know, women's characters, or a film that deals with women's characters? I mean, you co-wrote Kissing Jessica Stein, for example. I mean, you know, what do we do to sort of, like, you know, level the playing field here? Everyone and anyone.
Well, I just think, again, I mean, I had a psychology degree at college, and there is a cognitive phenomenon known as, you know, basic categories, where, like, there's a table, and then there's a coffee table, and then on the other side there's furniture. And our brains are wired to think this way. And I really believe that we need to know if the table is a coffee table, or a desk, or a dining table. We need to know. And so, unfortunately, for art, we're constantly labeling things. And because art can't be labeled, it shouldn't be labeled. Art should move you in different ways. It should be trans-labeled.
But I guess that's not just the label. It's the sort of the meaning behind the label, for example.
But then I would argue that there's a guy out there who's trying to write something, and he's being labeled as, like, Gen Y slacker asshole. Yeah. And he's like, no, I'm talking about my experience.
Sure.
And, you know, I think it is harder for women, probably because we've had these centuries and millennia of oppression and demeaningness behind us. But I think it applies to all of human experience, this nasty reality of labeling that doesn't help, that hinders in a way. But I think we are, like I said, I think we're wired to do it. So I don't think it's going to ever go away.
Do you think we're all wired to do this, to think this way, everyone? Or would you say? Any
it would seem so.
Come on.
It's marketing, because if you get a book that looks marketed to you like it's chicklet, and the cover looks like it's chicklet, then your mind is going to, pop it into that category. Yeah, it's going to categorize it like that. But if we are given things without that wrapper around it, and we look at them for what they are, then of course.
Well, maybe the solution is to go ahead and take something like The May Queen, put like some sort of, like, Tom Clancy cover on it,
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I don't think we should put a Tom Clancy cover on it. I think we should put, you know, like, the next great American novel by, you know, Jonathan Latham on it, because I do believe that there is a difference in the sort of books that, you know, that the new book by the great female writer may be a great book in the domestic arena, but the new great American epic, I put epic in quotes because it always comes with that.
It's by Hemingway or Fitzgerald.
Will be from male, due to marketing and due to sort of expectations.
Jonathan Brandon, Jonathan Levin.
That the great American novels of epic quality are from male writers, not from female writers. So I do think it would be interesting. If any of us who have done books, we know, for our publishers, we write the copy for the back of our own books.
Yeah.
And that's how it works, you know.
And but then we get pressure after you turn it in. Well, you know, I don't really know that this is going to appeal to your reader, so maybe we need to add, like, the mysterious stranger here, or, you know, add this element that's going to appeal to women who are the people who are actually buying books.
No. Well, I have a confession to make, Nikki.
Like, a little along these lines,
when you first sent me the book and I saw the cover, I was like, wow, that's lovely. It's really, like, it's arty. If they really want to sell books, they should put a chick lit cover on there, like a cartoon of a girl putting on her high heels.
And
I
just,
the fact that we're having this conversation, I'm a little freaked out, because I really did think, like, I think the chick lit cover would sell more copies. Not that this is a chick lit book at all, but, you know, I did have that thought, so I had to confess that to you.
I'm surprised by that.
I worry about selling books too, but I worry about selling films. It's sort of the same thing, but in a different medium.
Well, and that leads me to a sort of a question that comes to mind, is that you all have written in some capacity. Do you feel that the fact that you are a woman has really gotten in the way of that? Or perhaps you could describe this. Maybe what's needed, you were mentioning Jonathan's earlier, we need like a female Jonathan, a trusty first name that people will remember and go nuts about. I don't know.
Right. I think men are writing about big issues, you know, they're writing about topics, and they try to make women, when they label them in this way, they try to make it out that women are, they're only writing about personal conflicts with feelings, and that way it doesn't appeal, or it doesn't have as broad appeal as a Hemingway or Fitzgerald or you know, The Corrections or whatever.
I think we can no longer say that women don't get a fair shake in the publishing business in terms of actually publishing, because in the publishing industry, there is a belief that women, and perhaps this is, you know, completely based upon statistics, that women buy more books. So I honestly believe that it's probably easier to publish a book as a woman than it is to publish a book as a white male. But that said, I do think the way your books are positioned as a woman are different from the way they're positioned.
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd dichotomy, because there's a big difference between the quote-unquote publishing industry and books that win prizes and books that are critically well-received. I mean, it isn't too far from Norman Mailer's characterization of women novelists as authors of tiny domestic dramas. I mean, that, you know, this was, this not the, you know, debate between Mailer and Roth of, like, you know, 15 years ago,
or even Mailer and Greer, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, yes, Mailer's been in a debate with pretty much anybody we can think of, but no. I mean, yeah, it's an aesthetic issue, it's a psychological issue, it's a you know, anthropological issue. It's probably more complicated than we have time to talk about here tonight.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a deep vein to mine.
That is true. And I will just offer up, is because I feel that we should show the other side. Marilynne Robinson got so much attention with Housekeeping, just a beautiful book, and it's been taught in women's studies programs and MFA programs for decades.
Yeah.
And her new book comes out, and she gets, I believe, for her new book, all the respect that, you know, a Norman Mailer would get for his
Mary
book.
Gateskill to some degree, too.
Yeah,
well,
that's,
you know,
true. Yeah.
Speaking from the perspective of film, you know, when I first sat down with my agent in L.A., she, you know, I was a little worried, like, I was new in town, and am I going to get work or whatever? And she was like, look, you're a woman in Hollywood, you write comedy. Female comedy writers are at a premium. And I found that, like, I was in demand, or, you know, if it was any vehicle that needed a female point of view, but it was comedic, you know, there was only a handful of women, like, sort of, that they had deemed able to do that. That said, meaning, I think for women writers, I think it's okay. In the directing realm, it's abysmal. And, like, something like a full 70% of films are directed by men, if not more. I'm not sure of the actual figure.
I think it's, like, more like 80, 85, I think.
It's high. Yeah. I mean, I read that 70% figure somewhere. It might have been about in the Academy or something. But the point is, the director rules the runs the show.
Yeah.
The film is a director's medium. The writer sets out the blueprint. The director delivers the product. And I've actually read articles where female film executives at studios have been interviewed and said, yeah, I think it's a man's job because it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and women have babies, and they can't do it, you know?
Oh, Jesus.
And it's like, that's the problem, you know? I mean, yes, it's 24/7, and yes,
women are generally the primary caregiver, but we have to figure out a way for, in the medium of film, for stories to be told by women too, because this is why we have all these ridiculous films with cars blowing up that no thinking person wants to see. Yes, a 14-year-old boy wants to see that. But, you know, our film, our art of film is in danger, I think, of eroding into complete and utter crap to the point of no return.
Yeah.
And I think if we can find a way to get more women at the helm, it'll help things. Because I think, you know, when you focus on stories about relationships, that's the human experience. You know, that is what that is what Fitzgerald is doing.
But not just that also, but like, for example, take someone like Sarah Silverman. This is considered, you know, a sort of like the top sort of, you know, female icon right now. And what is it? Well, she's known for, like, oh, well, she's the, like, the cute chick who goes ahead and spouts off sort of, you know, four-letter words.
She's
and,
got
like,
the pouty mouth and exactly.
She can play with the boys.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, you know, what do you think, this is sort of forever kind of embedded within the sort of the gender gap? Or what are your comments or remedies to this sort of situation?
I think there are a number of female directors out there trying to make it. Like, there's Gillian Armstrong, the woman that did Laurel Canyon. I can't think of her name right now. There's so many. And I approached several of them about being in the book.
Oh, really?
But they didn't have time to be in a book. You know, they're trying to make their movies in a man's industry. You know, it's a little boys' network.
And so, going back to one of Ed's earlier questions, Laurel Canyon, Frances McDormand is... by far, she is the sexy woman in that picture, not the 20-something chick in the tight jeans feeling desperate for her man. Frances McDormand is the one who has all of the sexual power in that film.
Oh, there was one thing I want to talk to you guys, to you ladies about. See, there I go. I said, you guys, even though you're all sort of women. So it's like, again, the patriarchal language there.
I answer to girl, answer to gal, whatever you like.
But, career and work. One thing that I noticed in all these essays is that there's kind of like this sort of, you don't explicitly reference work, with the exception of, I think, Kimberly's essay sort of, you know, got into very explicit details, but this notion of women not wanting to talk about work or what they do, I mean, maybe there's like a sort of kind of career, maybe this is a kind of a larger kind of stigma in American society as a whole about not wanting to talk about what we do because we're judged by our occupation. Why, maybe you might want to get into sort of why you may have refrained from certain sort of work details, or, you know, feel free to run with the ball here.
I think some of us did talk about work. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in my essay, for example, I might not have talked about work specifically, but I talked about the context of an actress worrying about her age, you know. And that is, you know, in my work, that is a reality that I have to contend with. And, you know, I didn't talk about going on set and what I do, like, as an actress, but I think I was trying to get into more contextually. I mean, after all, the theme was 30s, you know. So I've gotten to know some of these women now, and I can't imagine any of us would refrain from talking about work. We love our work. But I think it was the nature of this book. We wanted to really be honest about life in our 30s, and maybe work was peripheral or dancing around the edges. I don't know.
Some of them did more than others. Ivy Meyerpold talks about the execution of her grandparents, but then she also talks about working on Capitol Hill and becoming a director. I should have mentioned her before. She is a director. She's doing a show for HBO called The Hill. It's a series that starts in the fall. But there are a number of pieces. Have you read the whole book?
I have. I did. No, I think what I was talking about is that you... Oh, see you. Bye-bye. That was Megan Thom. Bye-bye.
But what were you saying
exactly? I was talking about sort of like the explicit sort of, you know, things. Like, you were talking about contextualization. And what I was talking about is, like, you know, explicitly referring to what you have to deal with at work, to sort of like, you know, what specifically within the work environment relates to sort of the gender gap. That is kind of what I was sort of not sort
Nikki,
of seeing.
Do you think that's so because there were so many freelance writers in the roster, and that kind of, that you don't show up to an office every day? And
that's part of it. Yeah. That's certainly part of it.
I think it may also have to do, well, my work that I make a living at is teaching.
Yeah.
But that is not my calling. My calling is writing. And I don't like reading books about writers. I don't like reading novels in which the main character is a writer. I think it's kind of boring. So I referenced teaching, my job, in my essay, but I didn't talk at great length about it because it wasn't really the center of my essay. But I do think that maybe that we think of work as the thing that pays the bills, and oftentimes the thing that pays the bills for us, not, this isn't always true, but oftentimes what pays the bills is not what we want to be remembered for, or what we consider our best, our most important work.
Sure. Yeah, I got you. But at the same time, though, you know, we're you know, women have had a sort of history in the workplace and in employment of sort of putting up with a lot of things that sort of, like, you know, are now finally in recent years finally being unfurled and dug up and things like that. And I guess what I'm sort of suggesting, where I'm leading with this, is that in not talking about sort of these details, do we sort of lose the fact, you know, lose kind of like shining the arc light on the fact that, like, women make 2/3 of the salary that men do, or that there is, like, you know, a man is more likely to get the same position than a woman.
Isn't that assuming that we're talking about the corporate workplace?
Not just the corporate workplace, but just, like, you know, all across the board, women are sort of, like, you know, there's still a considerable gender gap. And so I guess, you know, in not dwelling upon the details, I don't know. I'm just
kind of grateful to get a check for writing every day that I get it.
Yeah.
And for me, I don't think about it. Yeah, it's a privilege, and I have a day job that luckily I get paid to write, but it doesn't. It's like a small percentage of what I do every day.
Sure.
And my husband and I both work from home, and my daughter turned 2 yesterday, and it's been such a struggle to see him earning our living, basically making him home for us, and then the little money that I kind of piddle in, and the value of what I do, which is raising our daughter. And that, so it is. It's hard. It's hard to balance that.
But. You know, my husband makes a great deal more money than I do. But that said, I met my husband in graduate school, and the paths we took, I think maybe the difficulties in this situation are greater for him than they are for me. He took the path of getting the job that pays well. I took the path of adjunct doing. To live the life of an adjunct professor so I could write my books. He also wants to write his books, but suddenly we have a child, and someone has to earn, and he's the one who now, if I had the same job that he has, because it's a certain sort of government job, I would make the exact same salary. So I think in the corporate world, yes, there's a huge disparity, but in some fields, like teaching at the universities, much easier to get a job as a woman than it is as a man. And I think although there is disparity, in some ways there is less pressure on us as a woman, particularly if you're a woman in a family environment who has chosen to have a child, to make the big bucks. I mean, I think it goes both ways. I mean, you know, certainly there are arguments on both sides.
Erin, you've remained conspicuously silent. Do you have any thoughts?
I'm just thinking about it in terms of craft and each essay being crafted, and that we were choosing what worked for the essay and what didn't. And so for me, telling what I do for my daily work, and I, you know, I freelance, I teach, I work at a restaurant, I work for a nonprofit, that wasn't relevant for the essay. Or I think I said that I did the things I went through the experience I did and was able to do all these other things despite that, but it just wasn't, you know, it's Flannery O'Connor said, when you're finished with a story, you turn it over on its side and shake it, and what remains is essential and what falls away is not. And it wouldn't, I don't know, the work details weren't essential. So it's not that work is not a huge part of my life, but it wasn't a huge part of the emotional core of the essay. So I feel like it's probably that same way with the other essays
I think maybe men are forced to define themselves more by work than we are forced to define ourselves.
Okay. We are sort of like running on empty soon, but I was wondering if anyone had any sort of final thoughts or questions that you might want to sort of, like, you know.
I'm just so pleased to have everyone here together. It's so great to finally meet. I'm really excited by it.
I know, it's exciting to have the dialogue in the flesh, you know.
Sure.
When we were all writing our essays, I mean, speaking for myself, it felt like dropping something into a vacuum, having no idea the context or the company, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's been really nice to be with everybody and
so who met each other just tonight? I mean,
we all did.
We all met.
Really. Except I knew Nikki and Michelle. Kim.
Nikki,
but I didn't know anyone else.
A few of the writers, but really everyone just met tonight.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I've that I love that Nikki was able to do that, that she was able to go out and find all these diverse voices and give us a theme and come up with
she
it.
She spent so much time doing that. I know. She was trying to find diverse voices.
You did it all by email.
She worked so
hard. How was the organization process for
this? I'm not an organized person, so but there
you
was
seemed
no
very
process.
Organized.
Yeah.
Last
I'm
week,
just fortunate to have all of you.
I was teaching these residencies to eighth graders in Lincoln City, which is sort of an underserved city on the Oregon coast, and it was harrowing. And I was reading this book a lot while I was there, and I was reading the thanks page, the acknowledgments page, and I completely started crying when I read your thanks to everyone who'd written it, because I did feel like we'd all given a lot, and just, I was so moved by it, just by you putting it together, by everyone doing it, and probably because I had been teaching eighth graders all day. But it just was a really amazing experience to be part of.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, I'm going to go ahead and, I guess, wrap this up if no one has anything else to say. But I want to thank you all very much for agreeing to do this crazy sort of podcast here on the fly. We've got plenty of material here. But thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.